The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go beyond reality.
I'm your host, JV Johnson. We've got a great show for you tonight as we kick off another week. Always looking forward to Mondays. You know how some people say, the Monday blues, the Monday this. I get excited about Mondays. You know, the weekends are nice. Don't get me wrong. I enjoy my weekends just like everyone else. However, Mondays, we get back into the swing of this stuff. We get to talk about a lot of fun things, and that's what I like to do. Although the first thing I'm going to talk about tonight is not so fun, sadly. But before we do that, tonight we'll be talking with Sarah Main. Sarah is a teacher and a transformational coach. We'll talk about her new book called Conscious Confidence, Use the Wisdom of Sanskrit to Find Clarity and Success. So it'll be an interesting kind of a self-help program tonight. Looking forward to that. How do we feel better about ourselves? Now, I know that this is a little bit controversial. But for those of us who have spent most of our professional lives in radio in one form or another, we recognize the contributions that this individual has made to the broadcast community. And I'm talking about Rush Limbaugh. Obviously, there are people that love him and there are people that like him or that hate him. But I will tell you this, there are a lot of people that love him because he is the most listened to radio personality in the world. And not just, you know, in the last 5 years, not just the last 10 years, not just the last 20 years, but for over 30 years. In fact, he is so popular that he single-handedly saved AM radio when he started his syndicated program back in, I think it was 1988. And not only did he single-handedly save AM radio, but he actually single-handedly saved radio. And, there was a period in the 90s, and I know because I was part of the market then, that, radio's future was very, very uncertain. And it was programs like Rush Limbaugh. I'm not saying he single-handedly did it, but he didn't do it by himself, if that makes any sense. Because what he did was he invented the modern-day talk radio format. In fact, this program, what we're doing right now, Rush Limbaugh had a hand in paving the way for this. What Art Bell started doing in the 90s, Rush Limbaugh paved the way for that. His views are controversial for a lot of people, but there is no question if you're a broadcaster, you recognize how important his contribution has been to the broadcast community. And he announced today to his listeners that he has advanced staged lung cancer. That is never a good diagnosis, obviously. He's going to be undergoing some treatment, and I'm hoping that everyone can put, whether they're a fan or not of Rush, put their political views aside and wish a man who has done a lot for a lot of people a speedy recovery here. It's a difficult road for him ahead. And my father, in fact, went down that road, and it claimed him rather quickly. So hopefully that won't be the case for Rush Limbaugh. Sorry to kind of start this off in a bit of a morbid sense here. I don't mean to do that, but I did want to make sure we had a chance to talk about what Rush will be going through. A couple things I'd like you to do. If you're listening to this show as a podcast, please go to YouTube. Go to the YouTube channel, find JV Johnson, subscribe there, become part of our online YouTube community. It's a great place with over, 500 plus back episodes of the program, plus some bonus content. Great chat room when we're live. A lot of great stuff there on the YouTube channel. Again, go to YouTube, search for JV Johnson. Please subscribe to the channel. Hit the notification icon so you're alerted when we go live and or when we upload bonus content. If you are watching this on YouTube, if you're one of the people that either watch it live or watch it later on YouTube, find the podcast as well. You probably have a smartphone. You probably have a podcast app on that smartphone. Go into the podcast app. Search for Beyond Reality Paranormal, find the podcast, and subscribe. And that way the show will be delivered to you every day. And if you've already heard it, fine. But if you haven't, it's right there for you to reference, whether you're on a drive, a commute, sitting on your back porch, and taking a walk, whatever it happens to be. It's a great way to listen to the program. It's edited and uploaded every day as a podcast, and everybody with a smartphone has very, very easy access to it. You can also find it on things like Stitcher and Spotify and Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, all the major distribution points for podcasts. So again, subscribe if you have an opportunity to do that. I'd appreciate it. And the final thing I'll ask you to do, then we're going to go to break and get our guest ready to go. The final thing I'm going to ask you to do is to go to Facebook, find my page. JVJ Paranormal is the way to find it, or just JV Johnson tends to bring it up as well, and give that a follow or a like, and be part of that group for us as well. All right, we're going to go to break, and when we come back, we'll bring our guest in. Sarah Main is our guest tonight, teacher and transformational coach. We'll be talking about her new book. It's called Conscious Confidence: Use the Wisdom of Sanskrit to Find Clarity and Success. Please support the program. Go to patreon.com/johaw. That's J-O-H-A-W. Our guest tonight, Sarah Main. Sarah is a teacher and a transformational coach, and she has a new book out. It's called Conscious Confidence: Use the Wisdom of Sanskrit to Find Clarity and Success. Sarah, welcome to Beyond Reality. Great to have you here with us tonight.
Thanks so much, JV. It's great to be along.
Now, you are in, I believe, Sydney, Australia. Is that right?
That's correct.
First of all, about halfway around the world, which is pretty amazing. But secondly, how are things progressing with the fight against those unbelievably devastating fires throughout Australia?
They're still going. They settled down for a little bit. They haven't fully gone out. And then another fire further down south has flared up. So the air's pretty smoky. Yeah, it's going on. People are, battling on.
Yeah, well, I tell you, we here can't even imagine that type of fire. I mean, we get wildfires for sure. I've seen satellite photos of the Australian continent, and it seems like the whole thing's ablaze.
Well, certain sections of it, but it's been particularly bad. I mean, fires are a part of life. I'm born and bred in Sydney, but it's been particularly bad, and it's bad.
Well, our hearts, prayers, and hopefully some help in whatever form people can send, or you're in our minds and our prayers. So hopefully, there's not much more of this, and it gets under control, and people can resume what we would consider to be a normal life. Our prayers are with you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much.
So let's talk about being a transformational coach. What does that mean?
coaching is a different modality from counseling or therapy. Coaching is about where you are now and assisting the move forward to what you want to achieve, what you want to do. And the element of transformation is also in transforming yourself, raising your awareness so that you can experience and give expression to the greater part of your potential that you have to offer. And there is an element in good coaching of transformation. And I've certainly found that that's an important element in the coaching work that I do.
And what does it mean for you to do this for people? I mean, you must get a great deal of personal satisfaction out of helping people this way.
Oh, absolutely. It's seeing someone in one place where they are and they feel trapped in some way or limited. It just may be they're in the wrong type of career or in the wrong role in the work that they're doing, or it could be more a personal life situation. Needn't be, hugely dramatic, but just a sense of things not being quite in alignment, not quite right. One client said to me, I've just lost my mojo, which was a great thing for a client to offer you as a starting point.
I'm not sure I ever had any mojo, but that's a different story.
But this guy lost it, but he found it again. And that's so exciting, because what you see is someone becoming all that they can be, or more of who they can be, and giving expression to that, which is great for them, but inevitably it's great for everyone around them, their family, their friends, all the people they work with. I mean, this is how we transform our lives, our society and communities, is by transforming ourselves.
Do you think it's a fair statement that everybody has an element of you said things are not quite in alignment, or it's a dissatisfaction with career or maybe relationship or their financial status? I mean, everybody's got an element of this in some part of their life. Wouldn't that be true?
Yeah, basically, yes. I think it's the nature of things within a human being, but particularly the people that I'm meeting now, this seems to be the case. There's something not quite right, and it's a case of how do you start resolving that, because it just seems like we're hardwired as human beings to seek to be in alignment. It's not satisfactory that we can just put up with things if they're not quite right, which is exciting in some respects because there's always an opportunity, but it can be frustrating if you don't know where to go and what to do.
Is it the case that it's the situation somebody finds themselves in, again, using an unsatisfactory career as an example, does that unsatisfactory career create the problems within the person, or do you think the person has, as you said, this unalignment or this misalignment within them that makes them not be able to be satisfied with some of these things?
Yeah, I think it's it always starts from within yourself, and that's not a blame thing. Far from it. If you're in the wrong role or the wrong career, it'll be because of something that just wasn't, you know, you weren't quite aware of, hadn't come into alignment with who you really are and what you have to offer. And that's fine because what you've been doing has got you to this point, and that's great. And part of the transformation is to embrace what's gone before, take the best of it, and then be prepared to let that go and move forward. And that takes courage, certainly, and a determination and resolve. However, it's largely getting into alignment and then within yourself and connected to yourself properly, and then things tend to just roll out and flow from there. And then there's always plenty of energy and opportunities, and you just find, I just find myself, you know, I experienced it, but the people that I work with, they just sort of say, oh, wow, who knew these opportunities came, this, that, and the other, and they took them, and then they're in the right place, you know.
Let's talk about your experience a little bit here. I know that you had maybe a fair word to use is an epiphany as a child, right? 10 years old. Tell us what happened.
Actually, when I was 8, I just had this profound universal connection. I was just standing on the back doorstep at home, you know, just a kid in the suburbs, nothing special. Just a complete connection. And I did feel this sense of a sort of, it was like from within and without. It's hard to put words to it, but this real being called to something I didn't know what. Anyway, and that never left me. But I was fortunate my parents were keen seekers. They came out from England after the war in the late 1950s to Australia. And they were seeking, and, you know, there wasn't a lot around then that was obvious. It's not like now where you can go on the internet to find anything. And they read things and explored things, and then they found these practical philosophy classes. And I can remember Dad coming home and saying, this is it, this is what we're after. And this was to Mum. And I could see their enthusiasm. I could see they were onto something. And they were introduced to meditation, which was unusual in those days. That was back in the late 1960s. And they meditated, you know, just normal suburban life, but they meditated. They was reading things and discussing things, and you know, this changed everything. And then I was, in 1971, Dad could see I was interested, and he said, do you want to come along? And I said, yes. Look, you know, I sat in an adult class of people studying philosophy. I didn't actually understand a lot of the discussion. I was 10 years old. They're adults. And yet I was completely connected to the energy, the feeling. And when they practiced mindfulness exercises, I just found that really easy. I just connected straight away. And then a few months later, when I was still 10, I was introduced to meditation, and, you know, so it was just a natural connection for me, and I've just always been interested in it, you know.
Do you think in those classes that you went to as a child where you were surrounded by adults that you may have had an advantage because you were a child, that you haven't, that you haven't built up any preconceived notions and maybe haven't closed your mind to some of the things that adults tend to close their minds to?
Look, absolutely. I laughed because it was a great advantage in some ways, but I suppose no one knew how to relate to a child's experience, and I didn't know how to communicate a child's experience. It was just the experience, which is it's immediate and direct. It's not like you're an adult and then you have an experience as a child. You're just there, you know. It's not a separate experience or a separate state, as it were. And I think that's the trap. There's a sort of a plus and a minus there, because as a child, it was just how it is. It was simple, immediate, and yet then I would hear the adults all discussing it and overcoming any barriers and so on. And as a child, I didn't know, and no one knew to say to me, "Look, don't worry. This is an adult experience they're talking about." So there were certain elements of me that wondered, so, gee, did I miss something? Have I missed the point of this? And it was only as an adult I sort of undid some of that self-doubt that came in, because I realized that those immediate connections were true, and that was an adult overlay to have to sort of go through these other things.
Do you think that awakening, that realization you had on your back porch at 8 years old, do you think there was a spiritual component to that?
Oh, completely. The spiritual component was the whole thing. But, you know, like I say, for children, it's immediate. They don't have sort of worldly and spiritual as two separate things, so to speak. It just is. And so that experience was total and abiding and was complete connection with another realm altogether. And yet there I was standing there, and I think I went and got my bike after that and went riding up the street, you know, as an eight-year-old does. But that connection where you don't sort of go somewhere else or do something else to be spiritual or connect with the spiritual, that has never left me, because it is immediate. It is here now. You know, there are other levels of consciousness beyond just what we experience with our senses.
As you started to learn these ideas, these philosophies, these concepts, and you were practicing them for yourself, I'm sure, for quite some time, when did you start realizing that it was important for you to share it with others?
I think it was just a natural tendency. I suppose I was just sort of naturally drawn as a teacher, because that's what I did for 30 years. I was a school teacher, and I had always wanted to teach. I originally considered teaching at university, and then my husband actually became a school headmaster, school principal, and he turned to me and he said, "I need a teacher on. I need some more teachers." And so I ended up teaching at school. I never quite got to the university level, which was fine, because I can, trust me, teaching well to young people, you really have to know your stuff. But I think it was just natural, and also it is, I've observed, it is natural in human beings that when you experience something, you then want to pass it on. It's natural.
Yeah. So the teaching came first, and then you realized that you had some things that were of great value that you could teach others beyond what the school curriculum was, and you decided to start to share it in that sense.
Yeah, definitely. I think, in the philosophy classes, as you went on, and you know, obviously once I became a young adult, there were opportunities to be a tutor of a philosophy class myself. This was in the sort of evenings and weekends and on residential seminars and workshops. And so that was a great honour and an opportunity to work with other adults also seeking and working on themselves and studying philosophy and meditation. So I had a lot of experience there. And then when I started school teaching, I had the normal curriculum to teach, but the school was founded on these philosophical principles, and we were a normal school in that respect, normal private school, fee-paying school in Sydney. But we also had the added advantage, really, of teaching mindfulness. And we had a weekly philosophy lesson with the children. Now, that started when they were 5 years old, when they started school, 5 to 12 years old. And, you know, that was hugely privileged to sit with children and to be teaching this because, you know, you are right on the edge of having to be present with the child and appreciate their experience rather than overlay any adult concepts on them. So it was very beautiful, very illuminating. I learned a lot, but you could see for children this was seeds going into their being that then they could take through their life.
At some point, you, and this is how you describe it, you say you were seeing all the crying in the world, which led you to this current project, which you call Conscious Confidence, in the book that's of the same name. What were you seeing in the world that made you feel like you needed to put this together and really put this in high gear?
It was really this crying, an expression, a crying need. What I started to see was, and now it's everywhere, but this was a few years ago before it was actually in the media and everything, oddly enough, I just noticed this constant references to how terrifying something was, how frightened people were, how scary it is. Words like this: it's terrifying, it's frightening, it's scary. And then, of course, all the talk about anxiety, the mental health, all those issues. And I did notice it beginning as I was towards the end of my teaching time. And I taught for 30 years, you know, a few years over 30 years. And I noticed towards the end that was starting to come in. And my husband, who was doing a lot of interviewing for parents to enroll their children in the school, so he was talking to parents all the time, he noticed this sort of existential fear in the parents that used not to be there, and particularly in the mothers. They were just anxious and nervous all the time, and mothers used not to be like that. Now they were. And so the conversation he had at enrollment was quite different because of the presence of that. And that's not a judgment. It's just it was a noticeable trend. And that was part of what prompted me. And then also I had taken up learning the harp, which is something I always wanted to do since I was 10. And I finally got around to it sort of 40 years later. And my harp teacher was running a workshop and for a weekend for harp players. And look, I was just a beginner, but she said, come along. And I went along, and one of the sessions was with a psychologist dealing with performance anxiety for musicians. And there was a room with like 30 harpists, and they were all discussing the problems of intense performance anxiety and how it's very prevalent these days for musicians to take medication to deal with the performance anxiety. You know, that was amazing. And then I started looking into all of that with performance anxiety, and, you know, I knew a bit about fight flight, but I really have went into it in depth, read a lot of books, did a lot of research over some months. And then I thought, there's more to it. There's something here. I could just feel it in myself. And I started then thinking, what is happening when you're confident, when you're actually confident in yourself? There's a self-assurance there. What's going on? And as soon as I asked that question, it was like the lights went on. Go back and look at the Sanskrit, which is, of course, my background was in Sanskrit. And so I went and looked up Sanskrit and what does Sanskrit say about just the word confidence. And I came up with 12 Sanskrit words all related to confidence, and I started researching those. That was months of work going into the etymology of them. And I felt like I was just being led through this whole process. I knew what was happening. I could feel it. I just had to keep following and doing the research. It was fascinating. And then I spread it. Once I sort of got to a certain point after about 6 months, I spread it all out on the dining room table. I thought, there's something here. What is it? And I said, honey, to my husband, honey, come and have a look. What am I? There's something here. I had it all spread all over the dining room table. I said, there's something here. What am I looking at? What's here? What's it telling me? And he said, my husband's brilliant at this. He said, right, let's start grouping things. And so we just got all the research, and as soon as he said that, all this material started there were certain characteristics and they fell into four groups. And that's how I got the focusing, uniting, simplifying, and energizing. And it was just like, boom, it was all there. And then it's sudden, the Fuse program and everything just all made sense after that. So that was really, that's the story.
Well, we'll get into some more detail about all of that. We have to go to break here in just a minute. And I just want to get your opinion on this anxiety issue, because you made a real solid point about that. And I think that anecdotally, most people would admit to the fact that they see a lot more not only anxiety within themselves and within their families, but with their neighbors. It seems as though this idea of anxiety has become maybe one of our most, fastest growing health issues, if you will. Do you think this is an environmental result, or is this something biological happening within people? Where do you think it's coming from?
Well, look, you could pin it on all sorts of things externally, but, you know, from my training in philosophy and spiritual things and wisdom, it always comes back to yourself. It doesn't matter about the externals. It comes back to the connection with yourself, your state of awareness, your level of awareness, and your level of consciousness. And that may seem abstract, but it isn't. It really is how it works, and that's why I wrote the book, because 5 years ago there wasn't the same dialogue about anxiety, just that one word, anxiety, for example. And it's happened in the time I've been writing the book. All of a sudden it was like I was just writing this book just before it was about to hit all the media the way it is now. It's phenomenal. And I felt I was being led as I wrote this, and I felt I was being led by that very connection that I had when I was 8 years old on the back doorstep. It was like this was something I was meant to bring forward.
Just to touch on this anxiety issue one more time, It seems to me that what we're going to be talking about when we get into more of the details of your book and what you've researched and you're presenting to people, it's kind of the opposite of this onslaught of technology in our lives. That not only, I mean, obviously there's a lot of benefits to it, but I know even myself, I mean, if I'm, you know, sitting somewhere and I don't have my phone in my hand to do something, within 3 minutes, I feel like I'm going crazy because I don't have this thing, device to fiddle with while I'm sitting here. Technology has to be adding to this.
Yes, it's. I don't think it's the cause, because, like I say, it's a state of consciousness. But the fact that we have become so invested in the technology, is we have substituted that for a sense of self in some way or another. We're so invested that, as you say, if we don't have our phones next to us, and look, I'm the same, I've got my phone with me, but now I'm disciplining myself to leave it. You know, we refer to it as a phone, but actually right. We're walking around with a supercomputer.
That's right.
And I actually hardly ever use my phone as an actual phone.
That's right. That's exactly right. I think it's probably the same. I know it's true with me and probably with most. Sorry, you have, you've got a podcast and a YouTube channel as well.
Yes, I do. Yep.
Tell us a little bit about each of those just quickly so we know what they are.
The podcast is, I do a monthly podcast through Transformation Talk Radio, and they're filmed, and so they're put up on a YouTube channel, which is Conscious Confidence Sarah Main. So you can either listen to them as a podcast or watch the video. And really, I have been doing those now for a few years, and they're all based around the material that actually has come together in the book, and I have done podcasts on topics beyond that. But I just unpack and go a bit deeper into all this area of wisdom, knowledge, experience, transformation, and actual real connection, and how the Sanskrit works in with all of this. And a number of the shows I have co-hosted with Dr. Pat Basile, who was really the one who got me started on all of this, in some respects, because she just sent an email out to me sort of out of the blue. She saw my old coaching website and she said, I like the look of what you're doing. And she started Transformation Talk Radio many years ago, and she sort of got me onto doing the podcast. And then she said, you know, I think there's a book in this. And she's based in Seattle. So it's like I'm sitting in Sydney and just literally out of the blue. And I've just followed it from there. Yep.
Tell us about Sanskrit. Obviously, I think most people are just aware that it's a language, but it's much more than that, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you may have come across it if you've done some yoga if you've watched movies like The Matrix or one of the Star Wars movies. There's Sanskrit in the theme songs, in the theme music. A number of celebrities have got Sanskrit tattoos. It is actually hiding in plain sight everywhere. and in fact, it's the cognate. It is a root of English. So even though we've been speaking English now for, some little while, 20 minutes or so, we're fully connected with Sanskrit just linguistically, because a lot of our English words have come straight from Sanskrit.
Sometimes I feel like I've only been speaking English for 20 minutes, stumbling over my words here as a radio host. Anyway, but obviously there's so much deeper meaning here, and it's not just words and symbols. There's meaning here.
Yes. It's often referred to as the language of enlightenment, and it's an extraordinary thing about Sanskrit because and this is directly accessible to anyone, is that it brings the two things of sort of head and heart, the analytical and the intuitive, maths and music and the spiritual and the scientific, all these different aspects are all together as one in the language. The language itself is phenomenal in terms of its order and depth and breadth. It's amazing. I mean, it seriously makes, even though Latin and ancient Greek are magnificent languages, don't get me wrong, but Sanskrit, in my humble opinion, it eclipses them all, and I'm sure there would be a lot of Sanskrit scholars that would agree. It is a magnificent language, but it has this other dimension to it, whereas in the actual words themselves, in the language, is the potency of experience, that the knowledge and the energy is intact, and it just goes immediately to the heart, and you experience the meaning in the language directly. There's no separate experience. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
I'm trying to make it make sense, and I'm trying to understand how a language can have so much power. And I don't know. I mean, I'm assuming all languages are the creation of humans in one form or another. What gives certain languages, and particularly Sanskrit, more of this power that you describe?
Well, the word Sanskrit, it's actually Sanskrita. Is the Sanskrit word for Sanskrit. It means, the actual word means pure and perfectly formed. And it's that very purity at its essence. And they, Sanskrit is linguistically called a dead language, like Latin and ancient Greek, because they're no longer changing, unlike English. The English my parents spoke in England in the 1930s is not quite the English that we speak now, just because it's always changing and evolving. And,
right.
There's been a sort of a whole part of language that's come in just with the advent and development of technology. We talk about messaging and texting, and just these are just words that didn't exist before. Sanskrit is not like that. So it's unchanged, and in that way it's complete and unchanged, and in being pure and perfectly formed, the knowledge and the energy is intact. It's not diluted and changed. And the very structure of the language, each word comes from a verbal root, a little single syllable verbal root. And if you remember from your elementary primary school grammar classes learning English, verb is a doing word, it's an action, it's an energy. And so each word is derived from these verbal roots. And so the meaning, that's why it's experiential, the actual meaning is held in these verbal roots. And in the act of doing something, the meaning is there. So the meaning is what it does. And, I derived all the the work I've done from Sanskrit, and I don't want people to be put off by that, because really this, I've made it practical with stories and analogies, but you do get a direct connection with some of the pure and amazing wisdom that's in Sanskrit in a very practical and immediate way in the book, because Sanskrit shouldn't be seen as something just for academics, you know, sitting away studying with their books.
Tell us about the book, Conscious Confidence. Tell us about the title and what the book does for people.
Well, the title, going back to the when I spread all this stuff out on the dining room table and all my research, and I said to my husband, honey, what am I looking at? After we discussed this and we were standing up, shuffling things around, and all of a sudden I thought, bang, you know, the lights had gone on. And I thought, okay, what is this called? What is this? And about 5 minutes later, I was standing in the kitchen and just, well, conscious confidence literally was given to me, those two words. And I've just followed it. I've stuck to those words. They were literally given to me. I didn't even at the time have a full understanding of what that means. But that's the title, is Conscious Confidence. And the more I've gone on, it is that connection to yourself that is that very center of core self-assurance. So no matter what happens in your life, you have that strength to be able to step forward and thrive rather than be beset and crippled by anxiety and lack of certainty. Doesn't mean you're unsure if something's new, but you have a fundamental understanding that you have that strength of universal consciousness within you, and you can handle it, and you can learn from it, and you'll be fine. And I think that's a message that certainly has come through to me, that I hope that people don't think that a human being is naturally beset by anxiety, because I think in terms of the wisdom tradition, this is an unnatural state. The wisdom traditions talk about a human being a universal being, and that means universal energy, universal qualities, and we should derive our confidence from that knowledge. But we need to know about that. We need to be connected with that knowledge. The wisdom traditions have been saying it for centuries, for millennia, but I think we just need to have that represented and reminded, and be reminded of it. So the book starts with really just laying out a few basic terms, like why have I gone started with Sanskrit, about the wisdom traditions, all of that sort of thing, where I'm coming from. And then we start by talking about the body, mind, and heart of a person, a whole person, and bringing that into alignment and balance. And we go back to what the Sanskrit says about balance, which is this beautiful word, santulana. And santulana is all about measuring and balance, not too much of anything, not too little, just that right balance. And if we get that right in terms of caring for the body, mind, and heart and spirit of a whole person, of ourselves, then we naturally come into balance and alignment, because it's natural to be that way. And then the book proceeds from there, addressing what's conscious and unconscious, and then we get into values, attitude, and then the focusing, uniting, simplifying, and energizing.
If these concepts are teachings, and these concepts are things that we haven't, maybe aren't innate to us, or at least we're not aware that they're innate if they are. Is it something that we need to strive for to be able to learn how to do exactly what you just described, remove these anxieties and these barriers that we have within ourselves to be able to succeed and find, I guess, what would be considered to be a more blissful place?
Absolutely. We absolutely need to be taught it. Every human being does. I'm hesitating to use the word should, but we should all be taught this. This is basic knowledge. It's not sort of some otherworldly stuff that's for certain people. This is basic knowledge that we need. And the wisdom traditions are laying it out. There's this thread of knowledge that is available through all the wisdom traditions, and it has been there for millennia. And it's a case of connecting with it and learning. And it's not difficult. If it is difficult, we're not getting the real knowledge, because the real knowledge is practical, direct, and simple. But we do need to actually learn it. And if we're not actually learning it, then we're just left to whatever's drifting by. And to be honest with you, these days with the technology, what's drifting by on social media and everything, some of it is a bit questionable. And I think you can see the results of that. That just people don't know where to look. They don't actually know what to follow and trust. And I was supremely blessed to be given this from a young age. So it went right in. And, you know, I've just watched over the years people, I think, why are people doing that? And then I realize, because they just don't have that fundamental knowledge that you can follow and put into practice. And it's knowledge that works. You know, it stood the test of time.
You are probably unique in that you were exposed to this as a child and therefore have been aware of it, understood it, and maybe not completely, but, you know, were practicing it for a very long time. How do you think your life would be different if you hadn't had that exposure? Do you think this is something you would have found along the way? And if you didn't, how do you think your life would be different?
Oh, wow. No one's ever asked me that before. That is a great question. Thank you. Yes, I can't even imagine what it would be like, to be honest with you. I think I'd be a mess. I think I could see look, to be honest with you, I can't even imagine what it would be like.
Can you point to events in your life or circumstances in your life that you would not have been able to handle at least as well if you did not have this within you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just the pressures of teaching. You know, there are times where you know, it's just the any teacher anywhere will tell you come up against some tough things. You have to deal with tough situations. They're not easy. They're not always pretty. It's not nice. And you have to, if you're a teacher, if you can look yourself in the mirror and call yourself a teacher, then you need to actually address them, because this is the welfare of a child, or assisting with a family or parents or whatever, but is fundamentally you're there to serve the child and the needs of the child, and the parents have placed their trust in you to do that. You know, there were times where I honestly you just think, oh, either A, you wish this difficult situation would just magically disappear, or it hadn't happened, or, you know, God, what am I going to do next? And to be able to actually plant your feet on the floor, come back to that basic awareness in the present moment and fall still, connect with who you are, your presence, and then say, right, what, and then give your full attention to the matter in hand, to the situation, and then the knowledge was always there in the present moment what to do next. And, you know, that obviously there are processes and so on you go through in a school, there's systems and so on, but fundamentally to how to proceed where you just didn't sort of fall apart yourself or something, the training to be in the present moment and give full attention to the matter in hand and to come back to universal principle was just, you know, gold, invaluable.
And what about friends or family that have encountered something difficult in their lives? Have you been able to take your teachings and apply them directly for someone else's benefit and help them through one of these situations?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Lots of times. Yeah. And you know, look, I know a lot of friends who also studied philosophy as well, and they would all say the same thing. Yes, it's just like a golden cord that you can hold on to and stay connected with. And it all comes down to the power of the present moment, and all knowledge and all potential is in the present moment. And that's not some otherworldly experience. That's intensely practical. That's why they were called practical philosophy classes. This was taking it and applying the principles in daily life, sure, you go on retreats and things, which are wonderful, but you know, the real test is in your daily life. You know, when you wake up in the morning and the kids got to go to school and you've got to go to work and all of the things that happen in normal daily life. And, you know, the times where I had the opportunity to directly offer it in situations other than, say, my work or whatever, I just found again and again it was just like a revelation to people who hadn't encountered it before. To have something that was so reliable and really, really worked.
And that's what Conscious Confidence as a book does for people, I would imagine. It offers them these paths and these ideas to be able to deal with these things on their own.
Yes, yes. And it does take practice. It's not like, bam, you've got it straight away. But if you read, say, you're reading this book or you're listening to us talk now and you just think, oh, that's a different way of looking at something. And just reading something in the book where you suddenly go, oh, and you have a bit of an aha moment, already you're starting to think differently. Any aha moment is a shift or a change in your normal patterns of thinking that are just going on every day unconsciously. And those aha moments are so important because, you know, we talk about wanting to change our life. Well, it happens like that, where we actually start actually thinking about something differently, thinking outside or beyond our normal modes of thinking, which are, frankly, 99.9% habitual, and I'm being generous, you know, they're 100% habitual. And the, you know, the research says we think about, like, I think it's something like 60,000 thoughts a day or something like that. They've actually done some research. And out of that, about 85 to 95% of our thoughts are repetitive and negative, and we're unaware of it. And that you can Google that up. So, you know, to actually get some awareness, some aha about seeing something different, considering it differently, having a different meaning, because most of our experience of so-called reality is based on the meanings that we have, which is language-based. They're based in words. And they determine how we think and how we feel and then how we act. So we're literally speaking in ourselves into existence and our experience into existence with the language that we use and the meanings that we have for things. And these days, the meaning that's getting in is that everything's scary, right? And we need to be worried.
Right.
And that's where going back to Sanskrit and clarifying our meanings again, just getting a different perspective, use the wisdom of Sanskrit and find that clarity again, and then you can step forward into your own success.
What's the difference between conscious confidence and confidence as most people know what confidence is?
Yes, great question. Look, confidence, if you think about it, it's something that's coming up a little bit more now in and around media and stuff. But confidence is normally seen as either, you know, you're lucky, well, that person's confident, they were born that way, that's their personality, and I'm not a confident person. So it seems like it's a bit of a roulette wheel as to who was dealt the confidence gene when they were born. That's one view of it. Or it's confidence that's based on circumstances where you're familiar with the circumstances, you know what to do, you can be confident in those circumstances. And I venture to say that is more unconscious confidence. You know, yes, some people have got a personality that's a bit more out there, but fundamentally, those people, just like anyone else, if circumstances don't quite go their way, that's often then will show whether their confidence is founded in anything real in themselves, real and abiding. Because if the circumstances change and they're suddenly met with something that's a real challenge, does their confidence and self-assurance just dissolve? So often the loudest people who are out, sort of personalities that are kind of out there, they're not always the most actually properly, truly confident people. They've just got a personality that's kind of out there. And having practiced something and got good at it does give you a level of confidence, but the sort of challenge in that is that unless circumstances are known and sort of predictable, then your confidence can dissolve as soon as something changes. So there are weaknesses in all those situations, whereas conscious confidence is derived in a deep connection with yourself and your values, what's truly important to you, and some real wisdom within yourself. Just like a large tree has deep roots into the soil, it doesn't matter what storms blow, the tree stands proud. And really, that's the sort of confidence that just takes you through life no matter what's happening, and you can chart your course with self-assurance and with positivity, and you can thrive rather than just feel under threat all the time.
You have referenced several times wisdom traditions and wisdom teachings and wisdom ideas. When you use that phrase, what are we talking about? Are there more than one, and can you name a few of these wisdom traditions for us?
Yeah, sure. It depends where you look. You could just take Shakespeare. It's actually, you know, there's huge wisdom just in Shakespeare. And these are universal truths, if you like, universal wisdom that are then seen in different traditions and appreciated in different traditions. Shakespeare's magnificent. Plato, Socrates, magnificent. All the I had a lot of training in the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita, the Indian scriptures, which are the wisdom in those teachings is profound and so clear and precise. The Bible, of course. So all these different wisdom traditions, some have a religious element to them, and I have endeavored not to influence what I've written with that sort of thing, because I just wanted to provide some principles that are there, because those universal principles can then enhance if you are a person of faith with a particular religious tradition, then these universal principles can enhance and enliven and enrich the particular faith that you follow. So there's a universality in that.
When someone picks up conscious confidence for the first time, what do you hope they're going to take from it after they spend their first hours with it?
Oh, that is such a wonderful question. Thank you. I hope that they have their interest is piqued, it's sparked, to feel that they are delving into something deeper, and that they can journey within themselves to find out something new, something exciting, some new perspective that they want to stay with and they want to pursue and practice and discover. So perhaps I could say a sort of an inspiration and a sense of discovery that there's more to this than they realized.
We have a little bit of time left here, go over some of these things, but I want to, and I know we've talked about a little bit of it in bits and pieces here, but what would you say are the most common blocks regarding confidence for any individual?
It comes back to sort of a lack of connection with yourself. And certainly in my coaching work, that's where I start. It's a bit like getting, like if you have an appliance at home, like a toaster, and it's not working, and the first thing you do is check that the plug is actually plugged into the electric socket and the electricity switched on, and then the power can power the appliance, and the appliance can do what it's designed to do. I always found, and I find this in coaching, is to get my clients connected back into themselves is a bit like putting the plug back into the power socket and switching it on so that the power and the energy is flowing through again. And that's that alignment and connection with yourself. So that's that's a sort of number one place to start in terms of developing that real confidence. And like I say, it's not sort of being big and bold and out there and brash necessarily. That's a sort of personality thing. This is a sort of a natural proper confidence that just means you can get up in the morning and be positive and looking forward to the day and no matter what it brings.
Do you think that, you know, how you get there aside, but just the fact that if you face your daily life or your daily or major challenges within your life with a sense of confidence that you have a much greater chance of success?
Oh, absolutely. Because you, in a sense, you can determine where you want to be, what you want to do, and then chart your course, be confident enough to be able to take the next step, the next best step. Like all these great myths in the Iliad and the Odyssey in the Greek tradition or Pilgrim's Progress, or when you're called within yourself to discover to discover something greater. And then that could be just, say, in your career, you're looking for a more fulfilling career, something that really fulfills you, but also you feel like you're giving the best of yourself to what you're doing. You need to be able to get up each day and take the next best action and be forward-looking, be in the present moment, but chart your course knowing that you're going to meet challenges and working away, you know, finding a solution around those challenges, up, over and around them, you know, and not just stopping. And inevitably that means overcoming any limits that blocks you've got in yourself. And this is a natural way to live. It needn't be something special. This is actually how we're designed.
The book offers step-by-step guidance. It offers definitions. It offers ideas. You also include stories that are relative to prove a point and a lot more. So it's really all-encompassing.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, the approach I took was exactly this traditional way of teaching, which is simple stories that have absolutely the message so clear. And stories are great because they bypass our thinking mind, which can sort of derail the process slightly, goes straight to our heart where we go, oh, yeah, I get it. That's the message. And the universal truths are often embodied in these simple stories so beautifully. And I put in a contemporary accounts. Every chapter's got someone, either people I've worked with, people I know, children that I've taught, children that I know, who actually embody this, demonstrate the point that I'm making. And then the definitions are crucial. They're going back to what does the Sanskrit teach us about, for example, values? And there's a whole chapter on values. And that was amazing to me because I knew, you know, values, and we had school values and so on. But to go back and find out really, what does Sanskrit say about values? And it's amazing. It talks about the root of something and that which you honor, or all the energies around values. And they're so important to find. They're an important element in conscious confidence because it roots us, gets us rooted strongly in what's really important in that which we honor. And for example, important things like kindness or magnanimity or service, generosity, strength, courage, these, from the wisdom tradition's point of view, are not just nice concepts. They're actually mighty energies in the universe. And we all express, some more than others, a range of these beautiful energies. And it's great to be consciously connected to the ones that you relate to. And sometimes it's kindness, but sometimes it's courage. And to be aware that you're connecting to a mighty energy gives you huge, strength to carry on, especially in the times of difficulty.
If somebody was asking the question right now, what is something I can do immediately, something simple to help me cultivate some confidence, do you have a suggestion?
Yes. I think number one, I could think of two things. Number one is sit down and write down what are your three top values that are so important to you that really the things that you honor, you know, and really be conscious of your values. Is it honesty? Is it kindness? Is it courage, magnanimity, service? Come at three, maximum five, 3 to 5, your core values would be number one, because that's already starting to connect deeply with what's important to you, what's at the heart and the core of yourself. And number two is practice giving your attention to what you're doing, single-pointed attention to what you're doing. So if you're driving, giving full attention to your driving, coming into the present moment. If you're listening to someone, listen to them with full attention. If you're speaking, listen to the sound of your voice and speak with full attention. So those two things, come to what's important to you, the real core values, and those beautiful energies, those mighty powers, and give full attention to what's in front of you.
What about new work? Do you have anything that you're working on now that might be an update to this work, or additional to it? What else is going on?
Well, I've the book's out, and the audiobook's coming out next week, which is very exciting. So there's an audiobook. And I'm just starting work now on turning the whole Fuse program, the Conscious Confidence Fuse program, into a series of online courses of different levels, so people can work directly with the material, rather than take the book, and each chapter in the book's got practices, starter, intermediate and advanced practices. So it's easy, practical, gives you things to do. But an online course is good because it's interactive and people can work with me directly, as it were, because I can put things into the online course that aren't in the book. So that's number one. And then I've got other ideas for books. they're in development.
Well, you certainly don't want to get ahead of yourself, because this is just out. Conscious Confidence, just out. Yeah. So
January.
Where can people get a hold of the book?
The book's available at Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble, and on my website, consciousconfidence.com. And it's available in paperback and in ebook. And the audio book is coming out next week.
And you have a whole bunch of stuff on your website as well. What can people find if they go to the website, consciousconfidence.com?
Yes, there's a lot there. There's a blog. There's the link to all the radio podcast shows that I've done. And then there's also some magazine articles that have been around in quite a few magazines. And they're little potted bits of Sanskrit, how I've taken some Sanskrit and worked it into some practical wisdom for today. And there's also all sorts of other information and things to read on the website as well, so you get a feel for it. Because it can be a bit daunting at first. Sanskrit seems a little bit strange, and sort of, you know, that's for other people. But it isn't really. There's so much you can learn just from one simple word in Sanskrit, and some of the magazine articles might help to unlock that and unpack that a bit.
Great discussion tonight, Sara. Thank you so much. One more question for you. Do you know if Australia in general has any interest in American football?
There's probably people who know a lot about it. I know the Super Bowl's just been on.
Yeah, it was on yesterday. I was going to ask you if you were happy with the outcome, but you probably don't follow it much, huh?
I don't follow football in Australia, and we have about three or four codes of it. Trust me, there's a lot of it, Australia and football. But I have been to Kansas City, Missouri, and it is a beautiful city, and there's a beautiful statue of Winston and Clementine Churchill in the middle of the city, and all the fans. Yeah, it's a beautiful place.
All right, terrific. Well, Sara, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time. Great conversation. Hope to have you back sometime.
Thanks so much, JV. It was wonderful.
Beyond Reality Paranormal is hosted by JV Johnson and produced by Orion Palmer and Slick Eddie Edwards. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please consider supporting the program either through your podcast platform, click on the link in the description, or on Patreon at Joha Productions. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Paranormal, or you have a recommendation for a guest, contact our producer, Slick Eddie Edwards. Eddie is spelled with a Y at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com.